teaching at our own pace. And there is no linear progress. You just start from where you are and you go forward from there. And so of the vast amount of information that could be shared, what really matters, and maybe it's going to be just one concept from this morning, what really matters is whatever it is that's going to resonate with you and like fall into the slot, the already inward prepared slot. Because there's nothing that I, especially on this subject, there's nothing that I can tell you except what you yourself are ready to reach for. So the process is very intuitive from my side and also from yours. So this is an experiential workshop. All right? I feel like the masters are always standing, you know, a little above and behind me, and they have a perfect understanding of you. So what happens, literally what happens, whenever any of us speak who do it the way that Swami Kriyananda taught us, is that they tell me and I say it, but it's because you're asking. And so much more than most audiences realize, and I'm sure this is true for anyone who speaks, but especially if you're not reading a prepared script, it really depends on you much more than on me. Because if you're really interested in pulling energy through, then energy comes through. I'm just going to give this. I'm not very much into gender identity one way or another. But in fact, masculine and feminine qualities exist in the universe. And generally speaking, people in male bodies are more male than female and vice versa. Not always, but often. This class is very interesting because it's quite evenly divided between male bodies and female bodies. I have to be so careful these days. Very often, the classes have a lot more women than men in it. And when I used to lead retreats at Ananda Village, which I did for many years, many times a whole retreat weekend would be almost all women. So I was used to that. I've also been a woman for a long time. So, and I'm used to it. I had one weekend class which was all men.
Wow.
Very unusual. I had like 5 or 6 men, 7 men. And it was so dramatically different because they were all very thoughtful. They all accepted what I said and then kind of considered it. So after a while, I said, I feel like I'm playing tennis without a partner. I keep lobbing the ball over the net. I watch it bounce. And then it stops. And then I hit another one. So I've never had to urge a class to participate. But once they got the idea that that was what they're supposed to do, it just hadn't occurred to them that they were supposed to. I'm not speaking to any of you men, because I know many of you and you're very active. But nonetheless, you play a huge part. That was dramatic to me, because I could really feel how different their energy was. Okay, having said all that, we're going to just pray and then meditate for just a couple of minutes. I would like you to use this time to tune in with a very simple question or a very simple prayer, which is, help me to learn what I came here to learn. Open my heart, open my mind to whatever it is that you have to give me. And that will help me. And of course, that will also help you. So, let's pray together. Heavenly Father. Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Friend, beloved God.
Friend, beloved God.
Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ.
Babaji Krishna.
Babaji Krishna.
Lahiri Mahashaya.
Lahiri Mahashaya.
Swami Sri Yukteswar.
Swami Sri Yukteswar.
Beloved Master.
Beloved Master.
Paramhansa Yogananda.
Paramhansa Yogananda.
Saints of all religions.
Saints of all religions.
Humbly we bow to you all.
Humbly we bow to you all.
Help us to open our hearts.
Help us to open our hearts.
Help us to calm our minds.
Help us to calm our minds.
Help us to lift our spirits.
Help us to lift our spirits.
Upward into thy light.
upward and into thy light.
That we may receive your guidance.
That we may receive your guidance.
And feel your transforming presence.
And feel your transforming presence.
Oh, peace.
Amen.
Amen. Now let's just be silent for a couple of minutes. We will have a little battle between the need for fresh air and the children screaming outside, so we'll try to balance it. We'll have a little respite, but we'll just see what happens. I hope my voice carries. If you have trouble hearing me, we can rearrange the sitting between those who hear well and those who hear less well. I'll try to remember to speak up. Okay, yummy topic. Also, this can be very interactive. Sometimes I kind of get on a roll and want to finish my thought before I let you speak. But if I say something that you want to comment or ask about, do just kind of raise your hand and I'll stop. Because, again, this subject can go in so many different directions. Before I begin, I usually have everyone introduce themselves, but the class is so big. Did any of you come with a specific idea or reason why you're here today? Let's have a few volunteers. Something specific you want to know? Yes, Paul.
Well, I'm not sure how specific, but this idea of I think it's the greater the will, the greater the flow of energy,
okay.
The greater the flow of energy, the greater the magnetism.
Right.
So, without going into it at the moment, just for time's sake, I'll be brief. Up until about seven or eight months ago, that was really bad news because I had no will.
Uh-huh. Yeah, some of Master's teaching feels like bad news when you first hear it.
Today, as of quite recently, and that shifted significantly about 7 months ago. And if I had to guess what seemed to be the kicker, it was when I started meditating twice a day as opposed to once a day.
Okay.
That was huge for me. Well, recently, I'm really noticing the magnetism, the impact of the magnetism that has resulted.
Right.
And in terms of opportunities, in terms of money and jobs. This has not been an area of great success and abundance for me for most of my life. And suddenly...
There's more of it.
So I guess, I don't know if I have a specific question.
Yeah, but I'll write the words up here, will and magnetism. Yeah, they're important words, so I won't lose them. Excellent.
But I'm in a happy spot of like, okay, well, how do I choose which direction to go? Because there's more opportunities presenting themselves, and I can't do all of them.
What good news.
Yeah. It's
too,
really,
the
really
phrase
something.
Is called, too much fun stuff to do.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, that's like a wonderful problem. Mm-hmm. Too many fun things to choose from.
Yeah.
All right, anyone else? Yes.
So my question is more about whether it is thinking or intuition. Because sometimes I feel it is great, it really works out. Sometimes am I thinking in my head? So
yeah.
I think intuition question really interests me.
Thinking versus intuition, and I'll put one more, versus emotion. Swami Kriyananda said to me that I have very good intuition, but I also have a lot of emotion, and I can't always tell the difference speaking about myself, which has been a good guideline for my life.
Well,
yes, Christine.
That's exactly why I came here, because I always thought I had good intuition.
Uh-huh.
I would ask for God's advice, and I always felt I was given the right guidance. Recently, I've been in a battle over some situation that I don't find any solutions. And so when I pray for guidance, I think I'm getting guidance, but then I realize it's just my emotion or my will, and then I make these mistakes. So I'm finding myself in a situation where I feel I don't know if it's God's voice or if it's just my strong will or my strong desire for the solution that I want. That's sort of my dilemma.
Sub versus super consciousness. That's what you're asking. I'll clarify that. Anything else?
I think adding to that point, there's also this element of ego, which is, you know, it's part of the will, and I should and I shouldn't. And so when do you truly listen to it? When do you just say, no, this is not the right thing for me versus, so it's similar to that.
Good question. All right, other? Okay.
I think for me,
you see how active this subject is? I love to teach this stuff. I love to teach it now. Yes,
for me, there is such an element of control involved in this. So I feel that for real intuition, I have to get rid of control.
Control is a funny word. Yeah, I'll just put the word. Go ahead.
So for me, how it has evolved is that I don't trust it unless it comes through my dreams, because I know I don't have control of it, that I have control of my thinking and so forth. So I make these things come, and I realize, no, you can't call that intuition. It has to come in a way where I know I don't have control.
That's interesting, because, of course, if dreams can, we are in subconsciousness when we're dreaming, but dreams are either sub or super consciousness.
Yes.
They can come both ways. They can be subconscious, because the discriminating faculty is gone, and so any old fool thing can just have its day, right? They can also be super conscious, because the thinking faculty is not in control, and so often super consciousness can break through too. Yeah, so I do understand. All right, dreams. Because dreams are very interesting. I wouldn't have thought about dreams. I'm glad you said that. That's a good one. Yes.
So if you can elaborate on what should be the experience that we have once we follow the intuition?
Oh, like afterwards?
Afterwards.
What happens next?
How do we know that was our intuition versus...
Well, there's two ways to know whether it was intuition. If it works out well or if it works out badly.
That's what I mean. You see,
because
for you it could be like it wasn't what you wanted, but you feel good anyway. So.
Absolutely. A very, very good question. What happens next? Yeah, because we've all had the experience of getting a true intuition and then completely messing it up, which I've had, or getting a false intuition and then running into a brick wall. So it either works or it doesn't. That's how you can tell. Mm-hmm. Intuition is a razor's edge. But we'll have fun. We'll go on. Oh, Larry, let me go behind you then.
Sure.
Uh-huh. Larry?
Oh, okay. So I had a situation a couple of weeks ago that I was kind of battling with.
Yeah.
And I didn't really want to give it up. And I woke up one morning and I had a thought that was unusual to me. It was like it was outside of my normal thinking and feeling cycle. It felt like more like wisdom, and it wasn't something that I really wanted to do, but I knew it was the right thing to do, and it was very inconvenient and not fun. But I went ahead and decided to do it because of the way it presented itself,
right.
And even though I had some resistance to it, I just decided to do it. And so I went ahead, I followed through with that, and since then, it's clear to me that that was really a great thing to do.
Right.
Not in a way that is exciting, or, but in a way that is, it's like more of a freedom, and more like I followed like the light.
I understand.
In that, at least in this instance, I feel like that really was intuition.
So that what happens next and what does it mean? Biraj, I see a problem here. I don't want to erase this board, but I'm going to need another.
That
I know there's,
another.
If you don't mind, I think there's only one here, but
did this one come?
I have no idea. But I know there's some tripods downstairs. So, just look to the left, right there. She called. Open the closet. Do you see another? Biraj is gone in quest. We can just let it go now. Biraj will come back in a moment with another. You won't find it on the right. If it's not on the left, it's not
there's
anywhere. Yeah. All right. Who is next? Meg was next.
So it's about the brick wall thing. So you
the what thing?
The brick wall. Getting
the brick wall.
Yes.
You put it. What happens next?
So
the brick wall.
But then your intuition is so strong. It's like, is it the matter of time that things change? Do you want to hold on to it, or is the brick wall the dead end?
Yeah. No, that's
because you want to let go of it, but you kind of just know that it's not the end. So
what happens next is like a gigantic question, and it's very complicated. Everything to do with intuition is complicated. By its very nature, intuition is fluid. It's non-physical. It evolves. You cannot make it, I was guided to do that, mm-hmm. because but once you do that, you're not operating from intuition anymore. So it's just tricky, but we'll get there.
Okay.
Okay, Karen, did Pamela David, did you have something?
So in the Samadhi poem, it says, the storm of Maya stilled by magic wand of intuition deep.
Yes, it does.
And I just was thinking about that and, you know, thinking about this class and what an amazing statement that is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I came is, you know, in daily life, how do I tune in? How do I prepare myself best to receive a deeper intuition about everything I do? I mean, I just want everything to be as dharmic, you know, as possible.
I sent Viraj down, who has only one working arm, to bring something up there. I just hear a little stumbling down there. Okay. Sorry, I distracted me suddenly. Yes, you want to know, let's see, how about Dekha, every day is the word. You know, you want to...
Every day is Dharma.
You want to be every day Dharma. You want to be ready every day. What, you know, it's not just a question of when I'm meditating. Or whether my life is at stake. You want everything to be moving in the right direction. And it's actually self versus superconsciousness. This is the all pervasive phrase on that. Thank you. I felt a little bad when I realized what I've done now. Whoa. Okay. I realized you only had one working arm. I mean, that I've been thinking. Oh, that looks like fun.
A lot of stuff there.
Oh,
no.
Yeah.
We want to do something with this.
No, well, I'll use paper. Paper just looks like fun today. Then I can flip the sheets over, and that'll make me feel really nervous. Okay.
Should we just stick this?
Because I can write more. Okay. Very, very good. Anything else before we go on? Those were all absolutely terrific. Yes.
The only thing for me is I had been dealing with some decisions for a while until recently, and I had so much agitation and concern, and I felt very anxious.
Right.
And it wasn't until I was praying a lot, and I just kind of started to feel a sense of calm.
Right.
And that's my only perception or understanding of intuition thus far, was that was intuition, but beyond that, I don't have much of a personal experience or understanding of my own intuition.
Absolutely. Fear, calmness. Okay, anybody else? All right. You got it. I mean, there it is. It's all here, and let's try to sort of settle through it. Okay, I was saying that subconscious versus superconscious is actually the main starting point. So this is how you need to think of it. There are three levels of consciousness. There's subconscious. There's the normal waking state. And then there's superconscious. Now, this is a whole class in itself, just those three levels. So I'm just going to, I know many of you are experienced, or you can find this information. Subconscious is not used in exactly the same way that Jung popularized that term, but it's not unrelated to it. But go ahead. And then when we can't breathe anymore, we'll make the other choice. Okay. basically, what you're working with here is we're talking about levels of consciousness in relationship to the spiritual path. We're not limiting this to human psychology. It's in relation to the spiritual path. And all of us are divided between everything that we already know and feel comfortable with and have been doing, not only in this lifetime, but in all the incarnations before. And that whole explanation is part of the chakras, which many of you have sat in classes. And if you haven't already, on Asha's YouTube channel, Nayaswami Asha on YouTube, there is a four-part class on the chakras, which apparently is quite good because thousands of people have watched it and many of them have told me. I just toss it out there and then wait to see, but that one apparently really worked. But that explains how it goes from life to life, so let's just assume it. But all of us you know, you all can look around the room, and everybody looks so different, don't we? We have different contexts, different families, different nationalities, ethnicities, career paths. We're all so different. And every one of us makes perfect sense to ourselves, don't we? We just, it's just the most remarkable thing to me, how everybody makes sense to themselves. Because if it didn't, you would do something else, right? And that's because we're following a certain trajectory that's going to work for us. Now, people tend to think about spiritual life as here's the goal, and here's the beginning, and we think that we're all just going like this, and then we're all arrayed like this. You know, and some people are ahead, and some people are behind. In fact, spiritual truth is in the center, and we come to it like this. You know, that's my path. Here's yours. Like that, you know. So nobody is going in a straight line. Nobody's going forward by any measurable standard, because it all depends on this vast body of experience that taught us some things and makes us brilliant in this way, completely crippled in this way, mediocre in this way, not even interested yet in that aspect of it, but just gradually unwinding. One of the fascinating things that Yogananda said, every atom of creation is dowered with individuality. This is one of these unique and remarkable aspects of God's creation. Don't ask me why. You have to be on that level of consciousness to understand. But our individuality is not an accident, and it's not a superficial assumption. It is simply who we are. There's a Sanskrit word named word murk, and it apparently means silly. There's an actual Sanskrit word for silly. I was delighted when Swami told me that. It just made me feel very, I don't know, confirming somehow. And he told me that he met a Swami in India named Murk Ananda, which means infinite bliss through silliness. And one of Swami's friends, this woman who was hosted many sadhus in her house and felt she had the right to speak, said, "That's a really bad name for a sadhu." And the Swami said, "You don't know me," he said. "It's a very good name for me." Who can say? Hard to imagine at the final level of your renunciate life you call yourself bliss through silliness. But that was who he was. That was how he was going to be there. So all of us are following whatever we need to get from the outside to the inside. Because that's what we're following. It's not here to there. It's from the outside to the inside. So whatever we have to sort out to get deeper and deeper to the center of ourselves, that's karma. That's life experience. Everything you're doing is for you to get to know yourself better, to understand who you are and what you need, to become more powerful and magnetic in being yourself. Now, this is where the sub and superconscious comes in. Subconscious is everything you've already done. And that's why, you know, you can dream and go back into periods that you've been in, past lives, this childhood. This is why in your life review you discover, you know, people who have near-death experiences, and it's all in the movies now. You've seen it all. You get to see everything that ever happened. This is where psychology comes from, telling you that your childhood, which you don't remember, really influenced you, even your birth experience. If you don't have reincarnation, you have to bend it a little bit to make it work. I had a tough time coming out of the birth canal. That's why at the age of 45 I behaved this way. It's a little tenuous to my mind. If you add reincarnation, it starts working. If you don't have reincarnation, you have to hang an awful lot on a pretty fragile force there. So the thing about subconsciousness, for the most part, even if it's unpleasant, it's familiar. And there's a great comfort in familiarity. Just because it's always been this way, it seems natural to us. There was a woman that we met. She came to Ananda Village. It would have been in the 70s. And she was a sincere person spiritually, but she was really messed up psychologically and had even been on psychiatric drugs for a long time. She had very mixed karma. She had inherited a lot of money, was extremely generous with her money. At that time, we had no money, most of us. And there were about 30 monks and nuns, and she actually bought 30 of these bangles and gave them to all of us. That's how a lot of us who had no money at that time acquired these. These things now cost like $2,000. Then they cost $150, which was the equivalent of $3,000. Do I hear three from that room? It cost $150. Talk about inflation. In the 70s, but that money was inaccessible to us. She bought all of us these bangles. She gave them all to Swami Kriyananda. He wore them up and down both arms and passed them out to us. It was sort of fun like this. But in any case, but she was mixed up in many ways. We thought, naive that we thought we could cure her. So she stopped taking all her drugs, and like these 8 or 9 women, we decided that we would fix her, which was well-intentioned but misguided in the end, and it all worked out fine. But she was very difficult, and one woman particularly took her on, and that woman was a very feisty lady, super feisty, and so they would fight a lot. You know, she would yell at her and try to get her to do the right thing, and the gal that we were trying to help just always participated really well in all of this. So my friend who was trying to help her said, "Do you like it when I yell at you all the time?" She said, "Yes. It makes me feel close to you." Because that's how she'd been raised. She'd been raised in a completely chaotic family by people who were fighting all the time. So it was not pleasant, certainly not from our point of view, but it was familiar to her, and it was her definition of what a family is like and how you're close. Now, that was a very extreme example, but it was a very illustrative one about how the subconscious mind feeds you certain information that is not necessarily in your best interest, but that you can kind of settle back down to and relax. This girl was sure she was loved because we were yelling at her all the time. So she had no incentive to cooperate or be good, and she had every incentive to get us to keep yelling at her. You see how twisted it becomes? Now, an extreme example like that tells you that much of what's stored there is merely comfortable but not helpful if you are considering the goal of super consciousness. And there's several different ways to think of sub versus super. One is sub is contractive in the sense that it keeps you the same size you are or makes you smaller. Okay? And super consciousness is expansive, because it moves you past the known into the unknown and potentially moves you from limitation to freedom. The other way to think of this is you are compelled by the subconscious and you are free choice in the superconscious. Now, none of this has to do with what you're actually doing. It only has to do with which way is forward for you, depending on this incredibly complicated picture. I grew up in a very good family, and I'm very grateful to my parents and my siblings. You know, I had people grow up in so many tough ways. I didn't even know people didn't have good families until I was in college. And then I met some man whose mother had been an alcoholic, and I mean, it was a complete revelation to me. So I thank that. But my family was not, especially my father, he was not emotionally courageous. He liked to keep everything calm. So my mother was feistier, but my father would never fight with her, which was a little annoying to her, but she got used to it. But I grew up thinking that if people even raised their voices to each other, it was probably the end of the world. So I had a lot of investment in not having anybody yell at anybody, just the opposite of this other girl. So when I was 19, I was on the spiritual path, and I began to understand the difference between being compelled and having free choices. And I realized that what appeared to be harmonious was not actually harmony, it was fear. It was an intense fear of conflict. So it looked super conscious. Oh, I'm so harmonious. I'm so detached. Whatever you want is just fine with me. Oh, is that what you prefer? Oh, I'll happily sacrifice. But there was no freedom in it, absolutely compelled by fear. So far from going into the center of myself, I was shooting off as far away from my expansive nature as possible. I had to stay right contracted where I'd always been, right? So as it happened, I lived 3 months of my life in New York City. Highly recommended if you need to learn to have conflict with people. Live in New York City. People in New York City, they don't even notice. They're not mellow Californians at all. One of my friends, bless her, was married to a very sweet man from New York who's now in the Astral world, probably in the New York part of it. He was as dear as he could be, but he was from New York. She was a mellow Californian. She wrote to Swamiji, basically, when they were first married, before she'd kind of gotten adjusted, and basically said, what am I going to do with this man? And Swami wrote, don't pay any attention to him. He's just from New York. And she actually got used to it. He was just blunt, and he never couched his words. He spoke in just a verse like that. But he had a heart of gold. It was just what he was used to. So I'm in New York. I have to learn to get over my fear of conflict. Perfect. Because you can be so rude in New York. And in San Francisco, it would never fly. But in New York, they don't even notice. They just think you're having morning conversation. So I elbowed my way into the front of the line, and I pushed through in every situation, and I grabbed it if I wanted it, you know, just to get over my fear. Then I began to enjoy it. And I realized that's enough. Because I prefer to be harmonious. But harmony is not harmony if it's based on fear. Depends on what's at the center. Okay. Now, what this has to do with guidance is that we exist simultaneously, the superconscious and the subconscious, and I'll speak about the conscious in the middle. It all exists, and it's all me, and it's all you by definition. All of these levels are simultaneously potentially accessible to us. I didn't finish the thought. The conscious level, which is more or less what we're all on right now, does not have a separate existence. It is the battleground between the subconscious and the superconsciousness. And all that's happening all the time is contractive energy is trying to pull us back into the known comfort zone. Expansive superconscious energy is trying to make us bigger than we already are. And all the time we stand in the middle, and every single decision, Kamala Devi asked this question, every decision, we have a choice. Do I go expansive for me, whatever that looks like, or do I just stay where I've always been, where I'm comfortable? And there's just a few words that you need that you can guide the rest of your life by. I'm actually going to put this as lower energy, generally speaking, and or at least it takes less energy from you, and this is higher energy. And I don't necessarily mean higher vibration, just more. So I put lower and higher energy, more energy is what I mean. Generally speaking, it takes more energy to go in a new direction than it does to cruise along with whatever you're used to. That's pretty obvious, isn't it? So you have contractive versus expansive, compelled versus free, lower versus higher.
What do you mean by not higher vibration?
Well, it could mean higher vibration, but what I meant when I was writing it is, shall I just like sort of lie here and then just watch television, which is what I can do every evening? Or will I at least wash the dishes, which is going to take more energy, before I watch television, right? In every situation, you'll have experience. Shall I, just a moment, shall I master my fury and be calm? Or shall I just tell you what I really think? There might be a lot of energy in telling you what I think, but it takes more energy, higher energy. Okay? And it can also be more refined. But less and more is all I'm thinking of here.
Quantity.
Quantity. There's the word. Thank you, Larry. Okay, does that make sense?
So it sounds like for the person that was just lying down, having more energy could be, could it be a higher vibration for that person?
No, it actually might be better to get up and go out disco dancing, even drinking with your buddies, than just lying there watching television. Because it takes more energy to go out dancing and drinking than it does to lie there watching television, even though it's not a more elevated choice.
Okay.
It's a higher energy choice. So you can think of it as more or less, and you can also think of it as lower and higher vibrations. But more and less, is a very good template. Because more is almost always better. And then more good energy is better than more bad energy, but more energy is generally better than less energy. There was a question back there, but let me finish this. Swami Vivekananda, who was one of the first Indian teachers to come to America at the turn of the century, the end of the century and then early on, the 1900s, I have to make it more clear. And somebody came up to him. Vivekananda was a very powerful man. Someone came up to him and said, "Oh, Swamiji, would you teach me how to realize God? I really want to realize God." This is how the story is told. Vivekananda said, "Can you lie?" And the man said, "Oh, I would never lie." He said, "Can you steal?" And he said, "No, I would never steal." And Vivekananda said, "Well, my first assignment to you is to lie so effectively that nobody will know that you're lying, and to steal so skillfully that you never get caught. When you master both of those things, come to me and I'll talk to you about God." Now, what he perceived is what Haswami put it, that the man was not really good. He was just too lazy to behave badly. He was too lazy to sin. But what he really wanted to do was to be evil. And he needed to put out enough energy to be evil before he would have enough energy to be good. That's why it's very peculiar, yeah. That's why in New York, my little story, my being disharmonious and aggressive and, you know, loudmouthed to everyone was progress for me. Because I was nice because I was scared. In my case, fear. I had plenty of energy, but the energy was frozen. In his case, the man needed enough energy, and his desire was to sin. And he had to go there first. Strange story. So less and more. And that's why I'm emphasizing this. It's better to be a very, very good, very, very effective bad person than to be good merely because you're too lazy to be bad. You know, to look good is not the same as being good. That's what I realized. I looked good, but I wasn't actually good. Okay, there was a question back here?
You answered my question.
Okay, thank you, Paul. That's, you're getting to will and magnetism here too, but not completely. Now let me think where we are in this. Okay, so you have this whole picture. What this has to do with guidance is progressive, okay? And I've said from the outside in, if it's in the center here. When I was 20, I worked in a law firm. I'm not a lawyer, I'm a secretary, and I wasn't even a very good one. But I was a secretary in a law office on Montgomery Street in San Francisco. Must have been 21, just to be accurate. And there was a woman in the office who was getting married. She wasn't much older than I. I've always been very, very, whatever else I have or haven't been, I've always been very self-directed. My best and worst quality is that I have a lot of faith in my own point of view, which when I'm right is really good and when I'm wrong is really awful. And as someone who loved me said to me once, "You're not right as often as you think you are," which is what Swami was saying between emotion and actual intuition. But the fact is, I'm very personally directed. And, you know, I was a little too young to be a beatnik. I was right on the cusp of being able to be a beatnik, so I became a hippie. I mean, I broke out of the system. I was one of the first in my crowd to drop out of college, you know, to do all the things that we did in those days. So I was astonished that this woman who's getting married, which seemed to me like a very personal thing, was basically doing it out of a magazine. She was reading a magazine about what you're supposed to do if you're a bride and how you're supposed to relate to your fiancé. Everything was out of a magazine. I mean, that's a way of putting it, but almost literally true. I was so naive. I was very inexperienced. I was just shocked that a person would do something that was so personal by what everybody else told her to do. It had never crossed my mind that you would just get your values from the world outside. Yes, of course, that was naive. My problem was that I was naive. But it just stunned me. And I presumed, I of course lost contact with her, that she also got divorced, according to the magazine, because that would have been expected. Because everything was, well, I got divorced myself too, so who am I to say, but I did it in an original manner. Anyway. That was when I was 20. That was all my very early pre-Ananda life. Anyway, moving right along. But what I realized as I got more mature and understood this is that the first step in higher guidance is to move from your inner self and not merely be a reflection of the world around you. Now, that first step can be quite subconscious. It can be just what your habits, your inclinations are. It doesn't really have to be guided by God or have any higher values, but guidance is progressive. It's at least saying, look, this is who I am. I have this intense aversion from past lives of not being controlled by society around me. I've never been part of the feminist movement or anything like that because I've always felt it was behind me instead of in front of me. I just felt like I'm going to be myself and I don't really care what you think. I'm going to find my own way. Of course, I might have been more generous to my sisters, but I was already at Ananda, so I just dropped out of it. But I've never been, it doesn't resonate with me. It's not my fight. The idea that my parents would control my life, that a husband would control my life, there have been exceptions to that in my, but it's not in me. The story Anna Karenina, which is Tolstoy's great novel, which is all about this woman who gets trapped in society. I loved the book, but it infuriated me. It practically gave me bleeding ulcers to read it because I just didn't understand why she just didn't kick all those awful people out of her life and just go and do what she had to do. So for myself, I have often been subconscious, but I have rarely been controlled from the outside. But many people who are in the habit of being controlled from the outside need to become solidly subconscious. Solidly moving from what is genuinely yours. First, you can't go from being controlled from the outside to super consciousness. That's a little bit like just wanting to look good and wanting to skip the responsibility for owning all the delusions that I've spent lifetimes building, right? It's nothing particularly to be proud of, but it is your foundation. Swami Kriyananda said, you don't become a saint by taking saintly qualities and pasting them on. We become saintly, we become free, we become good disciples, like an apple seed becomes an apple tree. It's an image I use all the time because it's so powerful. I like apples, and apple seeds are really very pretty if you look at them, and they're so little. And some of my apples come off of apple trees that grow right around my house. And every time I pick an apple, look at the tree, it started from that seed. And think how many things that seed had to go through before it became an apple tree. And there was no way it could become an apple tree without going through every single one of those stages. And so it is with us, to get from subconscious to superconscious, you've got to work with what you are. And sometimes people come to the spiritual path with good intention. Our karmas are often very mixed. because they have some big part of themselves that they don't want to own. Maybe it's trauma, maybe it's pride, maybe it's some desire that they're ashamed of. Who knows? In fact, all of us come to the spiritual path because there's something enormous in our subconscious that is making us so unhappy that anything is better than staying there. But sometimes there's a desire not to ever have to deal with it. I'll just skip it. I'll just go right to super consciousness and it'll be over. But we have to build like the apple seed. So just to do what is right and natural for you, at least to be able to acknowledge, to perceive it, to own it, and then decide whether you're going to follow it or not. But you have to be very comfortable with it. Because otherwise what happens is, and it all works, I watched it now for almost 50 years, you see, so I know how these processes work. If you've got something in there that really scares the bejesus out of you, is bejesus a swear word? Okay. I'm trying to always use the right language. Swami never used slang, by the way. He never used slang because slang has a certain vibration, mm-hmm. and his vibration was so refined that those words just, once he said, I remember him saying very carefully, yes, the experience was really, and then he paused, the pits. And just those words sounded so funny coming out of his mouth. It really made me realize words have vibration. And words, I mean, what to speak of actual swear words and vulgar words. Swami says all, you know, nowadays, all the vulgarity comes out of the first and second chakras. I mean, all the words that are really considered vulgar, that people consider language, they're all references to the first and second chakras in their least uplifted way. So now I've gone so far, I've lost track of where I was. Where were we?
Scared the bejesus out of you.
The bejesus. Yes, it scares the bejesus out of you, right here. And you really can't face it. But it's not wrong to get some spiritual power and spiritual experience and spiritual tools. Because what I have seen is that sooner or later it will bust through. But if you're really serious about your spiritual life, you'll have a big net to catch it when it busts through. So even if you know you're doing that, just keep doing the right thing and gradually it sorts itself out. Sometimes I've seen it take 10, 20, 25 years. But when the power on the superconscious side is strong enough, the subconscious will just bust in. And then you'll have the capacity to navigate, whereas before it would sink you. But the most helpful place to be is to say, whoa, we're going to face that someday, but not now. Not now, because I don't have the intuition or attunement to deal with it. So I'm going to develop intuition and attunement. And then, in God's own timing, I can deal with it. But if you pretend it's not there, if you are compelled by its presence, if it's running your life from the back closet and you don't even admit that it's there, then you're in trouble. I mean, you're in trouble in the sense that everything's harder. And you'll find yourself zinging off without you even knowing why. Now, in terms of guidance, what this means is, merely because it feels terrific doesn't mean that you should do it. Because it can feel so in tune, so right, so natural, so dynamic, because it's really subconscious and is just totally in tune with everything that you already are, and there's not an ounce of growth in doing it. There's a lot of comfort. Okay, now the trouble with the whole subject of intuition and guidance is that the fact that it feels terrific and it feels so natural and it feels so wonderful is also a reason why it might be true. So there's no substitute in the whole subject of intuition for very, very sensitive, and I'll come to it more clearly in a moment, just sensitive awareness that this is a razor's edge. But you're still better to do what is right and natural for you, no matter what level it comes from, than to be afraid to do that. The big enemy in all of this is fear. You know, to be afraid to admit that I really want to go disco dancing, that I really want to get married, that I really want to dye my hair red, you know, whatever it might be. all the should, have to, ought to, my parents expect me to, my husband wants it of me. It's one thing to freely choose that out of gratitude to your parents, out of respect for your husband, out of love for your children. It's quite another to be afraid to do anything but that and be compelled. You see the difference? And it isn't the behavior, it's the attitude and the vibration. Okay, comments, thoughts, or questions? Okay, who's first? Ramda.
So, outward working inward.
Outward working inward, right.
Right. Developing a greater sense of self, self-identity, this journey of self-discovery.
Self-understanding. Right.
So I have these identifiers.
Right.
And within that, I am finding my voice, if you will.
Yes,
and
well put.
Speaking my personal truth, personal truth. But then as we progress along the spiritual path, identifiers, as I understand and whatnot, start to kind of dissipate and fall off.
Right. May. Yeah.
And so that inner awareness of what is right for you,
right,
or your personal truth, if you want, when the identifiers are sort of falling to the wayside,
right,
then does that move into something that you can start feeling is more dharmic for you, and it's just something tapping into a larger truth?
A larger truth is a way to put it. Here, I'll put it like this. Once a woman went to a friend of mine, whom I was advising in a certain direction, went to a psychic, and the psychic is someone known to me who's actually quite effective. But the psychic is not a saint, that particular psychic. She's a very ordinary person, except that she's a good-hearted person. I mean, she's not a bad person. She's a very good-hearted person, but she's not saintly. She's not really super conscious. Saintliness and psychicness are two different things. So this, my friend, came back with guidance from this psychic to follow the direction she eventually did follow and has fallen out of my life completely. Because it felt so right to her, the psychic read her energy, told her where her energy was flowing, and it was true, and she followed it. Now, I'm not a guru myself, so I can't say it was the wrong advice. I saw all of that, but I thought she had a higher potential. And so I would have advised her to, yes, acknowledge that, but put it aside and serve Master's work, that would take you closer to where you really want to go. So that becomes the issue. Is it expansive or contractive? Does it move you from... And yes, the less compelled you are, and one of the things that really compels us is what we identify with. What will become of me if I don't follow this thing that I'm so talented at or this desire that I have? A man said to Swamiji, he wanted to leave Ananda, this was in the early 70s, and go travel in India. At that time, almost none of us had been to India. Swami advised him not to. He said, basically, essentially, you're not spiritually advanced enough to really benefit from that experience. Now, in the 70s, going to India was quite different than going now. At that time, there were a lot of reasons why he said that. I just want to condition that. He said back, but I have such a desire to go. I'm never going to be at peace unless I follow this desire. And Swami, I've rarely heard him be so blunt. You have millions of desires, he said. If you think you're going to get free of them by fulfilling them, you will start now and never finish. That's what he said. So, but then it becomes sensitive. Because some desires do have to be followed. But it's the question, compulsion versus freedom, contractive versus and yes, that's the whole thing. But the less you identify, this comes back to the word ego. Yogananda's word is ego is the infinite self, I'll call it. The infinite self identified, and identified is a fabulous word. Identified with limitation. Those of you who are in the back will have to stand up to see the writing, but you can hear it. Ego is the infinite self identified with limitation. If I think I am solitary, alone, vulnerable, frightened, incapable of doing that, then even if God whispers in my ear that I ought to do it, my ego, this is how ego interferes. ego interferes, and there's lots of people use the word ego in lots of ways, which I don't think are as helpful as this simple one. Ego is the infinite identified with limitation. And therefore, ego often interferes with superconscious guidance because it says, no, no, I can't. Which also comes back to the word of fear. What would happen to me if I don't have children, I don't marry, I end up being alone, my career is a dud? You know, what will happen if the ego is identified with these things? God calls you to something that contradicts what you are identified with. Bear in mind, not what you are, but what you are identified with. Now, believe me, merely to say, oh, I'm just identified with, that's not really my reality. To say that, your ego laughs at you. Because it's deep. We've spent, I always say, you have to have a lot of respect for your delusions. You have spent many incarnations getting this confused. You know, we have invested an enormous amount of energy into this wrong way of thinking. So it's not going to go away just because it's occurred to us that it's not a good idea. It's, well, energy and magnetism, let's go a little bit to Will. The more energy you put into something, the more powerful the vortex becomes. Mm-hmm. So we have spent incarnations identifying in a certain way. I am a weak female person and I need my father, my husband, and my son to tell me what to do. Many, many incarnations. How could I ever make my own decisions? It would be so wrong of me to stand up to them. Think about that. And there are many cultures, some of them represented in this room, that are very family group oriented. Americans are completely different. When I was in Bangalore and they were asking me the story of my life, this group that I had just met. And then I said when I was 22, I met Swami Kriyananda and I decided I would move to Ananda, and it took me a year and a half. But I moved a year and a half later and they all said to me, what did your parents say? And I said, I didn't ask them. And then I added, it didn't even occur to me to ask them. You know, and they went, oh! You know, it was just horrifying to them. And then I pointed out the obvious. I'm an American, what can I say? You know, I don't identify with being my parents' child. It's just not a reality to me. Although it took me a year and a half, because I was married at that time, and my husband was reluctant. So I did identify with that. I wasn't willing to break that tie then. It broke right as soon as we got to Ananda, but I wouldn't break that tie then. So parents I didn't think of, but husband ruled me at the moment. Okay? So where were we with all of that? Oh, that's the ego. So the mere fact that you might be free, you have to put out a lot of willpower to develop enough magnetism so that there's enough magnetism in the new vortex. And this is where ego is not your enemy, because you get the ego, the infinite self, to identify with something less limited. You see, this is all directional. You can express the very limited or less limited. So the ego gradually identifies with higher and higher realities, but your ego is your friend. It's what you're identified with until the ego dissolves, because the infinite is identified with the infinite. But there's going to be a lot of steps along the way. And the degree to which ego identifies with limitation is the degree to which it's harder to hear divine guidance, because of really simple words here. Now I'm going to turn the page. And it's because I want and I don't want. And I want and I don't want, according to what I think will make me happy, will make me free, will give me what I want. But these are not sensible choices, generally speaking. These are compelled because of our old friend. Remember our old friend? Here. Let me tell one story, then we'll take a break. I had a very difficult decision to make early on in my spiritual life. Some of you have heard this story, but it's exactly apt to this. It was the time when Swami Kriyananda was very accessible, and I just was struggling and struggling with this decision, and it was an either-or decision. It wasn't there was nothing in the middle. And I so wanted to do the right thing, and I believed I wanted to do the right thing. I was 24. that's not an excuse, that's just an explanation. I was 24, I was really new on the path, and I went down to Swami Kriyananda's house. I say that because I lived uphill from him. So I went down to where his house was. He was sitting in an armchair, and there was a footstool, a padded footstool in front, and I was sitting on the floor on the other side of the hassock, like this. And he was very calmly talking to me, and I was anything but calm. He knew, but I was telling him the whole tale of how just desperately I wanted to do God's will, and how I was praying all the time, and just, you know, on and on. And finally, I started weeping, and I put my head down dramatically, and then, you know, I sobbed into my arm the whole time. So I'm just sitting like this, you know, just not unsympathetic, but completely unresponsive, just kind of watching me do my little thing. Very, you know, he was very loving, but he was not engaged with me. And I put my head down, and then I lifted it up, tears. It's so hard to know what God wants, I said like that. And I dropped my head dramatically. And then I think, I may have lifted my head by then, but Swami, again, very impassively said, "No, it's not." That was an answer to, "It's so hard to know what God wants." "No, it's not," he said. Then there was nothing else. He's not given to Zen koans as a rule. He was actually, especially with me, he was very talkative. But that, as I recall, was the last thing he said. And I kind of hung out for a little while, and then maybe we talked about something else, but it was clear the interview was over. So I left, and I went back to the little trailer where I lived, and I sat in my little meditation spot. And interesting, you see, the subconscious wanted to hear a different thing. So at first, what I remembered he said was, "It's not hard for me to know what God wants," meaning Kriyananda. And so my first thought was rebellious anger. Well, it's easy for him, but it's hard for me. And so I fought with him mentally for a little bit all by myself. Fortunately, by the grace of God, I am more sincere than that. Also, I have a very strong mind, and it occurred to me that Swamiji would never answer like that. I never knew him in all the years I knew him to claim a superior position. You know, to just say that would just be say, "Well, I'm good at this and you're not. Tough luck, honey." I mean, like, where is the help in that? He could, of course, said that effortlessly, but I never really mean it. I never knew him to do that. So I realized that he couldn't have said that. It would have been such an elevation of himself and such a put down of me. So I paused in my emotion and tried to think more clearly, and then I had said, "It's hard to know what God wants." He says, "No, it isn't hard." And he was just giving me philosophy. So then my response was, "Well, it's hard for me to know." But by that point, I was on the right track. So I had this great faith in Kriyananda, and I thought, "Why is it so hard for me to know?" This is all an inner dialogue, and a voice, inner voice, very clear, said, "Because you don't want to know." And in that moment, it was crystal clear to me. I knew exactly what God wanted me to do. I didn't want to do it. And I definitely did not want that to be the answer to my question. And so what I did was, I just spent a lot of time being sincere over here, being dramatic, being, you know, affirming all this stuff, because over here, the quiet voice of superconsciousness was saying, "This is what you have to do. Get over it, honey. Just come over here like this." So I said, "Why is it so hard? I don't want to." I said, "Why don't you want to?" "Because I am afraid. Because I am deeply identified with what is going to be taken away from me, and I don't know what will happen." So I changed the question. "Why am I afraid?" And then it got really interesting. It was super interesting, and I'm exploring that self. Who am I? What do I feel? What do I identify with? Do I want to commit to this? And eventually, I just came very clear, and it was okay to be afraid. It was okay for me to say to God, "Whoa, I think this plan of yours is really a rotten plan." And it scares the bejesus out of me to think that I'm going to have to break all those attachments and go in this new direction. So, but then the whole discussion is not what does God want, but how do I gather the courage to follow it? Okay. Which was still no small challenge, but at least I was dealing with the real issue, which was fear. And then it comes down to, where's the word? Control and trust. Thinking, intuition versus emotion. These are all subconscious versus superconscious. So ego, willpower, all of it emanating from this word. Ever since then, which thank God was early in my spiritual life, whenever I am confused, I ask myself, not what does God want, but what am I afraid of? Mm-hmm. I get terrific answers. Mm-hmm. And you may still say, and I have said, well, how about plan B? I just don't have the courage for plan A. And actually, one time with Swamiji, he wanted me to do something. I just couldn't. I tried. And then I wanted to be honest. I said, sir, you know, you told me to do this, and I just need you to know I'm not doing it. He said, he didn't take an extra breath. Well, he said, so much for theory, let's deal with reality. Just like that. And then he offered me plan B, which probably, if I'd been able to follow plan A, would have saved me a lot of trouble. But I couldn't. Because it's okay to be yourself. As long as this is where subconscious versus superconscious, just say it. Say it out loud. Nope, not an option, Lord. What else you got in your box? Okay. Now, I'm going to stop there, but that's a good place to take us up in a minute. Let's take about 10 minutes. Get water, get some fresh air, whatever you need.
You have to be attuned for intuition to really come through.
Intuition and attunement are pretty much the same thing, yeah. Because the point is, you see, we're always attuned to something. Yeah, thought. This is from Autobiography of a Yogi. Thoughts are universal, not individual. We tune into vibrations of consciousness. We do not create it. So attunement is not a question of will I be attuned, because we are. It's what we're attuned to, which goes back to sub and super consciousness. What is influencing me, not am I being influenced? Another way of saying that is, what vibration of consciousness, what radio station am I transmitting? And can I change the station?
Yes, that was just going to ask, how do you choose to change that?
Meditation, devotion, service, affirmation, you know, jnana yoga, karma yoga. I mean, just the whole spiritual path. Because every day we're putting out energy, and energy creates magnetism. The more energy, the more magnetism. Magnetism attracts vibration, intuition, wisdom. Magnetism attracts itself. So whatever kind of energy you're putting out, that's your magnetic field, and it's going to, like attracts like. That's the station you're attuned to. That's what Paul is talking about. So the more willpower you put out, the more magnetism you generate. The more magnetism you generate, the more you suck in energy on that same vibration. And basically that's how you change your destiny, is with willpower, energy, magnetism. Because it's an energy universe. There's nothing solid about it. It's all just whirlpools of energy. There's nothing fixed anywhere. So if your whirlpool of energy shifts, which you influence by your willpower, then your destiny shifts, which is what you said at the beginning of the class. Exactly.
And is that what happens when people in the New Age say that if you think too much about something, like you're going to get it, something material, for example, it's not like they're creating it by the thought itself, but it's about the magnetism?
It's exactly the magnetism. Now, yes, like attracts like. That's what you want to say to yourself. Like attracts like. That's just the way it works. Because this whole universe is energy vibrating. And the reason we don't all merge and smash into each other is because we're vibrating at different rates. And so because we're vibrating at different rates, we don't mesh. So when whatever you begin to vibrate with, you begin to mesh with. So it's not a curse to say if you're afraid of something, it will happen, because it depends how much willpower and energy you put behind it, and therefore how much magnetism you generate as to whether you actually will draw to you. So some people who have very weak will and very weak magnetism and just worry about everything are not going to draw everything to them because they're just not generating enough force. But by the same token, the more powerfully your magnetism shifts, your energy shifts, the more likely you are, okay, in this room, how did you get here? You know, this. Think how big Silicon Valley is. Last night, I went down to pick up a dinner for some friends on Castro Avenue on Friday night, which I haven't been down there in years on Friday night. Right. I don't go. And I went to this restaurant because we were having takeout. Mm-hmm. I never go eat there anymore because it's too noisy, and I can't talk to my friends. So I'm in a place I never was. There were a lot more people just at one corner of Castro Avenue than there are in this room. So why were all those people there, and why are you here? You're here because you put out energy and willpower, which created the magnetism for something to come into your life that said, maybe this teaching has something to offer you. Whereas I could have given the most persuasive talk on the corner of the street there, and I don't think anybody out there would have heard me unless I was standing in front of East West, and then the ones coming in would have heard me, right? Because it's magnetism. So it's not a mysterious thing. It's not like, oh dear, they're not thinking that thought because I'm going to draw it to me. You know, sometimes people, because will and magnetism play a part in it. To come back to Paul's question about that, will and magnetism is important. If you're putting out puny energy, you're going to get puny results. But if you're putting out puny energy, unpleasant things may happen to you, not even so much because you drew them with your thoughts, but because you were drifting along so much that just whatever wave there was is just going to knock you over. But if you're putting out a lot of will and magnetism to be yourself, then your own will come to you because there's somebody home, right? And that's why Vivekananda told that man to become a thief, because he didn't have enough magnetism to draw anything to him. And the only thing he would put, Vivekananda knew that man would put willpower behind, was greedy self-interest. But at least then he'd be developing willpower. And then after he got good at that, he could use that willpower for something else. Which is why you have to be yourself. Because there's no energy in being somebody else. And then you can find out who you are by putting out energy, and then you can move on. Now, was that answering your question? Was it close enough?
But it's okay. We can talk about it. I think it's out of the subject. So
okay. Yes.
I think this might be along the same lines, but I've heard a couple things that helped me. One is that what I focus on, I tend to create more of.
Right.
And one of the things that helped me to stop worrying is like praying for something that I don't want to have happen, which is along those same lines. But mostly, you know, what I think is really important. And if I pay attention to what I think, I can kind of train my thinking for my consciousness, and that's been a big deal to me. Like, I really try to pay attention to what I let get into my brain.
Master said, take care of the minutes, and incarnations will take care of themselves. That is quite a statement. Because every minute is the same level of importance. Because every time you think a thought, it creates a vibration, and that vibration sticks with you, and 10 minutes, 50 minutes, 10 years, 20 years, you are with the vibration you've been putting out, that becomes your magnetism, and what you draw to you, like attracts like. So there's never, and this is the good and the bad news, there's never a moment when it doesn't matter. I mean, we have to take holidays. All of us have to take holidays. Sometimes you just lie down and you watch television. But you just you don't say, this is a good thing to do. This is making me exactly who I want to be. You say, Lord, I'm taking a time out. One of my friends, this is in the book Loved and Protected, which is on sale downstairs, which I highly recommend. It's a great book of stories of people's experiences of God's presence in their lives. And one of the stories says, you may think that you can't be a drug addict and a devoted disciple of Yogananda at the same time, but I'm here to tell you, you can. And then he said, of all of Master's teachings, you won't be surprised to hear that my favorite was when he said, if you're going to do it anyway, take God with you. He said, so I took Master to a lot of places I don't think he would have gone on his own. And then he goes on to tell this wonderful story of redemption. You know, but he was going to do it. So it's not like you can always stop yourself, but you can, there's always a choice between the most contractive and the most expansive. I'm going to be a drug addict, so I'll make it a little more expansive because I'll realize it doesn't separate me from God, even though I'm a drug addict. And the more contractive thing would have been, I'm a drug addict and therefore I have no relationship to God. You see? It's not what you do, it's the attitude you do it. So this man created a constant relationship with God, which eventually freed him. In fact, the way the story goes, which is really good, he just talked about hitting rock bottom, and he was out in the woods somewhere for various reasons, I don't even know why. He's all by himself in the woods. He hits bottom. He says, God, I cannot go on like this. And he said, inside, he heard an inner voice say, okay. A minute later, he was surrounded by police and arrested. In the middle of the woods. Just the police came. It's like, I need help. God said, okay. And then he's arrested. And he was thrown in jail. And he said, you know, he just hit rock bottom. Everything was gone. He'd lost everything. He said he didn't have his clothes on. They left him in his underwear. He said, but you see, he'd always kept the company of God. And he said, I don't recommend it. You have a choice. Don't do this. But he said, I was there. I'd lost everything except my relationship to God. He said, I was blissful. Now, that's how it really works. That's why that book is full of stories. That's why that book is so powerful, because it's full of stories of putting out the right magnetism. But he couldn't help it. That's who he was. It was too strong. All that time developing his drug addiction just couldn't be changed yet. But he kept at it. Okay, now guidance comes, let's see, how do we tie this to this, when I want to be close to God more than I don't want to be close to God. And everything else is extra. You know, meditating, not meditating, drinking, being nice, doing all your practices, it all helps because it makes you use your willpower, makes your magnetism stronger. But the single thing, I want God. Even if it doesn't show to anybody but me, I still do. Okay? And the more you want God, the more he'll talk to you. Now, I left us hanging over the cliff of plan B. So, but let me just ask what other questions there are before I go on. Yes.
Is the voice of intuition the voice of God?
No, because, well, yeah, but yes and no. Let me think for a second. A simpler way, see, part of it sometimes when you ask a question that is a little not phrased exactly, it's hard to have an answer. Okay? So intuition can be either subconscious or superconscious. And so it's the voice of God is, what does God want of me? There's a lot of questions. An intuitive decision can be simply consistent with your subconscious, but it's still more expansive than just letting other people tell you what to do. And so in that sense, it is the voice of God. All that God wants of us, okay, here's what you have to understand. All that God wants of us is that we open our hearts and love more. Love people, love ourselves, and love God. That's what God wants of us. We think it makes a huge difference where and how we do this. Do I marry? Who do I marry? Do I have children? How many children do I have? What job should I have? Should I live in Colorado? Should I live in California? Should I be part of this community? We have all these things. And we pray, should I do this? Should I do this? Should I do this? Should I do this? And part of the reason we get no answer is because God doesn't care. He really doesn't care. As Swami put it once indelicately to me, not to the woman he had just spoken to, really it doesn't matter what she does. She has so many lessons to learn, she could learn them in any number of ways. He didn't say that to her, but it was the truth. He said, you have to have very, 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 very advanced karma before it actually matters. And then you'll know. But oftentimes when we're so confused, one thing is, I say, we're not asking the right question. So for me, the story I just told, the right question is, what am I afraid of? But another question is that we're asking God, what job should I take? Which there is no divine answer to that. Because the question you want to ask is, how can I serve? Okay? The only thing God wants to know is, how can I serve? How can I love? How can I serve you? You know, how can I serve you, meeting God? How can I serve you? And then how can I love more? And if you ask God, how can I serve and how can I love more? And more, love more means God and mankind and the art that you do, the painting that you do, the books that you write. It's not just people. How can I express more love? How can I express more service? There are divine answers to that. But they're not necessarily material world answers. The answers are by opening your heart, by being less afraid, by having fewer likes and dislikes, by putting out more willpower, by having more magnetism, by flowing, not by controlling less and trusting more. Those are the actual questions, you see. So the other reason you don't get an answer is because God can't answer you. Divine Mother can't answer you because she doesn't care. It just doesn't matter. It's the attitude you bring to it, not what you're doing. You can make anything a mess, and you can make anything a benefit. You can be in a concentration camp and become a saint. You can live in the most perfect circumstances and still not be making any spiritual progress. So that partly answers, Christina was asking me at the break when I said, when I had to say, I want plan B. It's like, I'm not able to have a good attitude in these circumstances because my subconscious is just too much at war with what I'm trying to do. I'm tightening the screw too much. That was basically what I was saying to Swami in that. I can see theoretically this is good, but the screw is just too tight. And I can't master my anxiety in this situation. I've just got to loosen it a little. Because then I have a chance of having a better attitude. And he made an alternate suggestion to me, which I followed quite enthusiastically. And I said, well, is this, you know, is this a bad thing then? He said, oh, no, everything. He said, it just depends on your attitude. You know? He was trying to spare me a certain amount of learning, but I just didn't have the power. I didn't have the willpower to rise to it. So I backed up a little, but not too far. Yeah, it's perfectly fine to say plan B. And then if he doesn't give you one, then you have to give up control and begin to trust that if he asks it of me, he will give me the power to do it. And if you're standing on this side of something, you can negotiate. But if he has already picked you up and thrown you over the cliff and you're lying bloody and broken at the bottom, then really you've lost control already and you just have to trust. You can still rebel. You can spend a lot of time there just having a temper tantrum. But it's a good time to imagine that if he gives it to me, I can probably handle it. Or he'll make it possible. If not today, at least tomorrow. And it's the way I think about it is, our soul is determined to expand to infinity. It's just, and our ego is too. Our ego wants, our ego is that individual part of ourselves that drives us. I do not find it helpful. This is just the gospel according to Asha. I do not find meaning, but it's not, I'm not quoting anything higher than me, but I have not found it helpful to make my ego an enemy, because that always puts me in this vague conflict with myself, which does not benefit me at all. I do not find that helpful. So I do not like to say ego is the enemy. Oh, it's just my ego. If I didn't have so much ego, of course you have a lot of ego, that's who you are. But also, even when a master incarnates, he has some ego, because ego is just your individualized expression. It's the soul in a body, identified enough with that body to know which one to feed and which one to move. You can't get out of it that easily. So it's just a question of refining that ego, and ego is also the driving force. Animals don't make conscious spiritual progress because they don't have enough ego identity to make the decision to be better. They just get rolled along. I mean, and some animals can be very evolved, but they just don't have the nerve structure to be self-aware enough to reflect on their own experiences and make a decision. You know, your little puppy, as charming and as intelligent as he is, cannot say, why did I get this family when all my batchmates got other families? You know, why am I here where they're speaking French? You know, when I don't like the sound of French. And they give me wine here, and I prefer beer. Why didn't I get incarnated in Germany? You know, they can't think of that. They just go, oh, goody, goody, here it is. You know, next thing, like this. And minute by minute, they don't know anything. Us, we can think all those thoughts. And then we can make free will decisions. Use our will to change our destiny. And ego is what makes that possible. So you need your ego until it's completely identified with the infinite. And until then, it's your friend, and you just keep needing to educate it. And that way you're not divided against yourself. It's not ego per se. It's the fact that your ego is a little ignorant. And we need to fluff it up a little. Okay? I think anything that causes you to be at war with yourself is not a good idea. Because you are both sides of that battle, and it'll just freeze you in place. Of course you're stupid. I mean, just as Swami said, just take it as a given. Of course you're unworthy, he said. Like, why make a big point of it? Of course we are. Just start there. Swami himself explained something he did by saying, I was stupid. He wrote that in a book. I was stupid, in the manuscript. I said, sir, you are many things, but you are not stupid. I said, he just doesn't read well. And he answered me back by saying, but I was. I said, be that as it may, it doesn't read well. And so he shifted it a little. I mean, he was asking for feedback. But I find it, I don't like it when people come to me and just say, well, I know it's stupid to feel this way. No, I said, it's not stupid at all. You're not a stupid person at all. You're very sincere, which everybody is. And anybody who gets this far is not at all. So it's not at all stupid to feel that way. Maybe annoying, you know, maybe frustrating, but it's not stupid. We worked hard, as I say, to get this deluded. So it doesn't help to be against yourself. It just is what it is. Yes, David.
So I think we've all found ourselves in a situation where you're kind of locked in a situation, and you can't really think yourself out of it or intuit yourself out of it, because that's how you got into it in the first place. And you're hoping for some kind of divine inspiration.
Uh-huh.
And how does that maybe connect up with
intuition? How can I serve? How can I serve? How can I love more? Okay, let's start also like this, David. Did I cut you off before you finished
the
question? No. When I first came to Ananda, odd as it may seem, I was absolutely committed to Swami Kriyananda. I knew that wherever he was on the planet, I needed to get much closer to him than I was. Unless I moved. I could have been in Antarctica, wouldn't have made any difference to me. I could tell that he had what I wanted, and I needed to be closer to him if I was going to get it. Prior to that, I had been very devoted to Ramakrishna, who was an avatar from the 1800s, that Vivekananda was his disciple. That was what brought me on the path. And I had a very powerful connection with Ramakrishna. He was long since from this planet. I really didn't know any of his disciples. But he took really good care of me. So all of a sudden, I've got Kriyananda, but Kriyananda's directing me to Yogananda. And it's Yogananda and Ramakrishna that are really the pair up here. And I just didn't know anything about Yogananda, and I didn't, you know, because Kriyananda liked him, I liked him. But it was like that. But Ramakrishna was my real connection. So the only thing I knew was that I needed to be close to Kriyananda. And this business, I just couldn't sort out. But of course, I knew that being here meant that I had to somehow make this connection. But I couldn't tell because I didn't have the intuition. It was not a decision that could be made with the mind. Because Ramakrishna had been wonderful to me. I didn't want to just, you know, turn my back on him. I didn't want to be fickle. I just couldn't decide with my mind. So if I had just sat over here and tried to sort it out, I didn't have the equipment to sort it out. What I needed was greater purity of heart, greater intuition, greater understanding of the path. I needed all kinds of things I didn't have. And the only thing I knew was that I could get those from Kriyananda. So I took the tiny piece that I did know, and it happened to cause a radical change in my life, but it was really the only piece I knew, because I knew it would give me the intuition to solve this problem. And then when I had the intuition to solve this, then I would know what to do next. Okay, now this is a part of what we haven't gotten to, which is very important. Intuition is not fixed. You may get this absolute, you know, clear as anything guidance to go north. So now I am supposed to go north. I go north. And when you get one block, the voice of intuition says, now turn left. But I go north, right? Because instead of listening, we have dogmatized it, right? So you don't have to know the step that comes after. You just have to keep listening. And you have to commit yourself, but you are not committed to going north. You are committed to doing what you are guided to do. And that's where control and trust comes in. Mother Teresa of Calcutta, when they talked to her about helping the poor, and don't you think the government could do a better job of helping the poor, and how many people do you really help compared to this NGO over here? And Mother Teresa, this is on a film, she looks up like this, and she said, I'm not helping the poor, I'm doing what Jesus asked me to do. She was very blunt-spoken. I met her a few times. That's all she said. I'm not helping the poor, I'm doing what Jesus asked me to do. Blip, end of conversation. And that means that if Jesus said, forget the poor, go administer to the rich, forget the poor, go to, you know, she would have dropped it in a second. She never lost track of what she was really doing. Okay? And I hung out there listening to Kriyananda for about a year, just left this. I said to them, you boys sort this out. It's beyond me. You sort it out. I was there with Kriyananda for about a year. One morning I woke up and I said, of course, Yogananda. You belong to Yogananda. Why would you be here otherwise? And I felt Ramakrishna's blessing on that, and that was the end of it. But I never thought about it for a whole year. Yeah, just put it out of my mind, because I didn't have the equipment. I knew also if I held back from developing intuition, because I knew that Yogananda's path was true. That I didn't have doubt on. It was only a question of where did I belong. But I knew it was true, and therefore I knew it would train me. And then I would know. But if I stood here, I'd still be there forever. Satyavati?
Yeah. I have this little confusion right now. I heard somewhere from somebody that to develop intuition, the first step would be to just ask for everything. You know, when you're dressing up in the morning, just what color should I wear today? And now you're saying that that God doesn't care, and I know He doesn't care if I'm wearing green or purple, right? It doesn't make any sense, but it feels that it could be helpful, because then when you're going north and you keep asking,
you're in the habit of listening.
Habit.
You have the habit of listening. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll make it even more confusing just for fun, just to make it worse. Okay. In a class on karma, Swami Kriyananda said, everything that's already, the energy is already there in motion. And then I believe it was Dr. Peter said, or asked, and somehow it became about Dr. Peter. You mean whichever tie I pick out of my closet to wear that morning is already decided? And Swami said, yes. Now, that's one of those things I've just put on the shelf, because it's just too creepy to me when I'm cleaning, you know, shifting through my clothes, trying to find the dress that's clean and doesn't need ironing, because they all look alike, you know. To think that it's already decided which one I'm going to take. I just don't know what to do with that. Okay. But what you're actually saying, I mean, there's two ways to think about it. You can make yourself crazy by trying to decide which dress God wants you to wear. And that's sort of what I was referring to. We mustn't elevate every question to being a divine question. But the flip side of it, and everything about guidance has opposites, the opposites are all true, is whatever you're doing, take God with you. So it's less about what is my divine destiny and which dress will actually serve you better, Lord, the purple or the green. It's more a question of, well, Lord, what shall we wear today? And that spirit connects you. And there are people, and I have friends who are like this, who feel this sense of intuitive guidance for every little thing that they do. I don't have that up there anymore. Wherever it is it there? Yes. You see, here's a scribble. Everybody's different. That doesn't work for me. I actually do better if I'm not trying to make decisions all the time. But this is just the way it operates for me. I do better if I forget myself completely and just concentrate on how can I serve and how can I love and don't worry about the small stuff. Other people whose temperaments are different feel that they need to do exactly what you're doing and will speak with great conviction. And how I translate that is to realize I'm never alone and God is always watching. And if it matters to me what I wear, it matters to him because we're friends. Mm-hmm. You know, I try to think of God. I have a couple of really good girlfriends who they just don't mind how trivial it is. I could say, shall I wear the green or shall I wear the purple? And we'll have a real serious discussion about it as if it actually mattered. Because why not? So I can have that kind of a spirit. And that kind of a spirit really does. It makes God your friend all the time. And nothing about your life is too small. The habit is completely there. Because the other side about intuition is you have to practice when it's easier. Okay? Practice when it's easier. That was my question. Some of you have heard this story, but it fits. Practice when it's easier. That was my story to Swamiji about what do I do if I'm in a concentration camp and the guard starts brutalizing the person next to me. Believe it or not, that was an actual question I asked him. Hello. I think there's a black chair in the corner. And he said, I was asking Swami as a moral dilemma, being raised Jewish, born after the Second World War, was a real question to me. When I am in the concentration camp, which is how we all thought, my friend who is a WASP, just a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, she has her great-grandmother's punch bowl. And it's a question of who's going to get her great-grandmother's crystal punch bowl because it's been passed down the family for generations. I was totally bewildered by the question and the fact that they have owned this thing for generations. And then I realized, oh, you're a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. There's no pogroms against you. You never have to flee your country. They don't take everything away from you. My Jewish heritage, you never can keep anything, even to the end of your life. You know, subconscious. Subconscious for me is that you're always in danger and it's all going to go away. So I worried about it. Now, that's not a negative thought. I'm just pointing out to you. Subconsciously, she thinks that you can just keep your possessions for generations. It never crosses my mind that you can do it. Subconscious training. Practice when it's easier. So I ask Swami when I'm in the concentration camp and somebody brutalizes the person next to me, do I interfere or do I not interfere? What would be the best thing to do? It actually worried me. He said, what you're asking is, in a moment of crisis, how do you know what God wants? And then he said, you have to practice when it's easier. So the habit of conversation with God, you need to have the habit. It's less important that he actually tell you whether to wear the green or purple dress. Now, some people really do hear God tell them whether to wear the green or purple dress. But it's a good idea not to make your sense of yourself dependent on whether he does or not. Because it's unusual for him to tell you, because usually it doesn't matter. But for you to have a friendly relationship and feel that God is participating with you and making the decision with you is a very, very, very good idea. Okay, does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it all depends on the effect it has on you. For some people, when they try that practice, they get more and more depressed. They get more and more confused. They may actually become delusional because they feel this compelling need, like it's a failure on their part if God doesn't have an opinion. So gradually, subconsciously, they create opinions. This is a little bit of your question, is it the voice of God or not? That's why it's a little bit dicey. You can't let your self-worth depend on God always speaking to you. And this is a razor's edge, because simultaneously, for some people, it really works. So you have to watch very carefully. It does not work for me, which is why you don't hear me say it. self-forgetfulness works for me. And the calm assumption that if I'm just thinking, how can I serve and how can I love, my thoughts will be guided. There's a lot of times we're far more intuitive, and this is where thought versus intuition comes in. Thought is how God inspires us. Your thoughts and thinking in and of themselves are not the opposite of intuition. God inspires the physicist, he inspires the artist, he inspires the mathematician, he inspires the cook. Cooking was the first thing in my life I learned to do intuitively. I was responsible for the retreat kitchen at Ananda Village from 1971 until about 73. And at that time, a great deal of the community lived at where it was now the seclusion retreat, and nobody had their own kitchens, and they all had to eat in the kitchen that I was running and eat the food that I cooked. I was very enthusiastic about nutrition. I was a terrible cook, really terrible, because I thought if it was good for you, it was good food. Swami actually said to me later, you were so mental, you couldn't even taste. You know, your sense of taste simply didn't work. If it was good for you, it was good. So I also felt that if it was homegrown and organic, it was better than anything we purchased. I had no sense of money, so I wasn't trying to save money. But so during the winter, we had Jerusalem artichokes, sunchokes they're called. They look kind of like ginger root, and kale. Kale was not trendy and popular at that time. Kale was exceedingly obscure. As obscure as Jerusalem artichokes. Jerusalem artichokes, our gardener loved them because they're magnificently nutritious, incredibly good for a thousand reasons. And to my experience, grated in a salad, they're okay. Any other way of serving them, they are horrid, absolutely horrid. Even my friend, who is the best Indian cook that I know, just as an experiment, she made them. They were horrid. But I cooked them and served them to people. It was at least one of three meals included kale and Jerusalem artichokes, week after week after week. Then there was a rebellion. And a group of people came to Swami and basically pleaded with him to do something about it because they were dying. They thought if they met another Jerusalem artichoke, it would be ugly. So rather than come and choke me in my sleep, they went to him. So Swami came to me. This was all very much at the beginning, and I didn't know how Swami worked. But Swamiji will guide you if you are receptive. But if you are not receptive, he won't batter down the walls of your resistance. He won't argue with you. There's no point in it. So he said to me, by that point I was beginning to sense that there was something wrong, but I just couldn't figure it out because I didn't have the whatever. So he said, you know, the lunch you made today was a little, and then I just remember vividly, he paused, bland, he said, bland, perfect choice, not horrid, bland, he said. Yes, sir, I know it was. I tried to make it better, but it was. He saw that I was receptive. In fact, he said, much of what you cook is a little bland. And I said, I'd just love to do better. He said, would you like me to teach you to cook? I said, sure, you know. See, and now I grew up in a household where cooking had there was no value, no self-worth attached to cooking. We were entirely intellectual in our orientation. Cooking was just something you did. So I had nothing depended on my being a good cook. I had many, many issues of self-worth, but cooking wasn't one of them. So as it happened, this Swami Nirmalananda, who subsequently became Abbot George, and he's also Swami Nirmalananda still, disciple of Ananda Moyi Ma, American man, friend of Kriyananda, portly fellow who loved his meals. He's coming to Kriyananda's to visit for a weekend, and Satya Seva, for those who know, Satya was a man who's now passed away, Seva was Swami's right-hand person, and I and Swami, the four of us, spent Friday, Saturday, and Sunday together, three meals a day, and Swami taught me to cook. So I come the first day, and I have my pen and my notebook. This is how I learn, you know. I'm poised in the kitchen like this to learn. Swami's throwing stuff in, pulling stuff out, you know, opening the refrigerator, just as random as can be. And I'm desperately trying to left brain the whole thing until I just realized I couldn't. So for the entire weekend, I cut vegetables and washed dishes. I mean, and then Swami cooked like this. Sunday night, the last meal, I remember all of us were just kind of lounging around on the floor, because I remember Swami Nirmalananda is a very big man, was stretched out like that with his, I don't know how we got there, but he's on his arm with his rather large belly resting on the living room floor. We're talking about dinner. And we decide to have a fruit salad. Seva says, well, I'll fix it. And Swami says, okay, go ahead. And then, no, no, he says, and then with great exaggerated energy, I'm teaching Asha to cook, he says like that. So we went up there and I chopped fruit on Monday morning. I knew how to cook. I don't know how. I really don't. But I just knew what to do. It was just there in me. And ever since then, I've been a really good cook. And I cooked for Swamiji for years and so on like that. Now, why did I bring that up?
So no more artichokes then?
No more artichokes. Oh, your thoughts. Your thought, no more Jerusalem artichokes ever, except when Kavita cooked them for us in New Zealand. You were there, Atma Jyoti? Were you there? They were horrible. You remember how horrible they were? We threw them all away. Somebody gifted them to us. That's how we even had them. So what? Remind me what I said.
He was teaching you by intuition.
What did you... let me just get the thought of this. What did you just say? Oh, yes. Now I just have to find the thought there. Give me just a second. Oh, yes, thoughts. That's it, thoughts. That was the important point. You know, but when I'm cooking, God is not telling me what to do. I just open the refrigerator and this seems like a good idea. Wow, that could go together. There's no big woo-woo moment, you know, where I just... But this is my personality, you see. I'm a very, very feet on the ground, very... practical person. I just don't vibe with things that are not, that don't also satisfy my left brain. That doesn't mean you can't be different than me. But I've come to feel, and this is the best and the worst, ideas just come to me. I just start doing things and I just know what to do. Mm-hmm. And later I can see that there was a flow going on there that I didn't have to call anything at all. Mm-hmm. It was just, I start putting out energy and I know what to do next. And there's this absurd confidence, you know, there's this absurd confidence in cooking. You know, I'll try out brand new things on Swami or on other people who come to the house, you know, dinner party of 18 and I've never made the recipe before. This absurd confidence because, to a certain extent, thought and intuition have united. I have more confidence about that in cooking than I have had in writing because my self-worth, I want, I don't want, contractive, fear, all these things have infected me in writing. And cooking, who gives a damn? Excuse the expression. Because nothing is involved. And if they don't like it, well, it's only just one meal. They'll get over it. You know? But it's really my thoughts that are being guided. Now I've begun to understand that my thoughts are being guided when I write, too. So I'm much less afraid. But all of that came from how can I serve and how can I love? I mean, it was actually, I had to pause for a minute. How did that come? It's because those people were really unhappy and I wanted to serve them. You know? And I really did love them. I didn't want them to choke on the Jerusalem artichokes every day. I didn't want them to just think these are very good and I won't get diabetes. You know? They needed to like them. And I could feel that there wasn't love in it. They didn't feel it. So you just keep asking these questions and everything else follows. Because you are breaking ego's identification with the limited. Because how can I serve, how can I love means how can I put myself aside in order to feel God's presence. Also, that first lesson came from cooking too, because when I first started running that kitchen in whatever, 1971, I cooked three meals a day, 6 days a week, with an assistant who was not quite completely mentally there. This young girl who was, you know, a little daft, sweet, but a little daft. I mean, really a little daft. She'd actually literally had a brain injury. Very sweet person, but she'd had a brain injury, so she wasn't quite there. That was my staff, me, three meals a day, 6 days a week, and on the seventh day, I did laundry for all the residents and the kitchen, and I went and got the supplies. I drove this big pickup truck, you know, from the seclusion retreat all the way to town and spent the day doing all this and loaded everything back. I mean, I was strong. I was totally preoccupied with the kitchen. There wasn't minute one to ask any question at all. And I remember saying to Divine Mother, I hope you're in the kitchen because that's the only place I am and that is the only place my thoughts are. But what happened, I realized, is that people come up to me and say, just like a simple question, I vividly remember this, how are you? And I went, who? You know, like, who? Because I was so busy loving and serving that there was nobody home. And then I thought, ah, yes. We think of it as self-perfection. We're always trying to make ourselves right. It's actually self-forgetfulness. Not self-forgetfulness in subconscious, it's self-forgetfulness in superconscious. Yes.
Is that the story of the devotee in the ashram that spent his entire life
chopping wood and carrying water? That's exactly the story. That's Yogananda saying, how can there be humility when there's no sense of self? So for me, and this is just to explain it, for me to stop and ask what God wants about every little thing that I do, what I accumulate is tremendous self-concern. And it's not intuitive, it's just always worried about what I'm doing, which does not work for me. It could work for someone else, but given my particular zigzag, self-concern is my greatest enemy. Therefore, self-forgetfulness is my best friend. So even to spend too much time asking God, what do you want of me? The operative word in that tends to become me rather than God. This is art versus science. Science is there are great many techniques. The art is to know where you are in relation to the center and therefore which way is forward. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So is that one of the reasons why serving and loving others is so important, as it takes you out of that self-concern?
Swamiji actually says in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, the fastest way to overcome the ego is selfless service, especially for Rajasic Americans, because we're just so busy anyway that if we're busy in a way that causes us to be self-forgetful, this is where, and everything has its two sides, this is where in the cultures, especially where women fundamentally do not have any self-defined existence but merely live to serve, it also can be a path to liberation because you really live to serve. It's a fantastic and beautiful concept, but it depends on whether you're actually doing that or not. But in principle, it's beautiful, which is how, when I was much younger, I allowed my husband to keep me from going to Ananda right away, but it was also the divine decision. There was lots of reasons why it was right, but I was into that. You know, of course, I love, I serve, it seemed like the right thing, so we eventually went together. I just had to wait a little longer than I would have waited. But it was the right decision because it was about love and service at that point. Does that make sense? I was not oppressed. I was genuinely making a selfless decision that it was the right one. Okay, other questions or thoughts here?
Asha, would you describe briefly again that, I got the science part, but well, how did you describe the art?
Okay.
What part of this is the art?
You know, the part of this is the art.
Everything else is.
On Tuesday morning, Abhiraj, I think you were, Tuesday morning we have a staff discussion at the house I live in. We've been doing it for years. It's a very free-form discussion. We were talking about what day to meet, and Amara said that, Tuesday is for Mars and Wednesday is for Mercury in the astrological system like that. Nishkama next to her said, what is the authority behind what you say? Very, very nice question. And she gave some little. And then I, because, to quote Swami Kriyananda, the editor never sleeps. This was when Swamiji, I said that P.G. Woodhouse was ridiculously entertaining. He said, no, you mean he is entertainingly ridiculous. Mm-hmm. If you're a wordsmith, you understand the nuance. And then he sort of apologized by saying, the editor never sleeps. So the editor and me never sleep. So Nishkama says, by what authority do you, well, what is the authority behind what you said? And you can write that, or you can say, who said that? And the question is the same. Mm-hmm. By what authority do you assert that? Who said that? Exactly the same meaning. And so, because I'm writing a lot right now, I'm always looking at it, words like that. Which one really wants to say what you want to say? Because there's a million words, and it's the same meaning, but the art is which one of all those words are you going to use to really, in this case, say what you really want to say. Mm-hmm. Elicit the response you really want to get. And it isn't a question even of clarity of meaning or anything like that. It's uniquely in the circumstance. If Nishkam had turned to Amra and said, who says that? Says who? You can imagine it would have elicited a very different response from her than what he said. But it was the same question. So if we're thinking about our spiritual life as we should, as a relationship, it's a relationship between ourselves and our higher selves, between the devotee and God, sometimes between ourselves and all of mankind, between ourselves and the spiritual path. I mean, it's a relationship in every direction. So there's an art to what you have to do, and it isn't just the science of who said that. It has to be done artfully, or else you don't get the result you want. So that's why the art and science of Raja Yoga. You can just get the science. You see, when you just get the science, what you get is dogma, or you get institutional religion. This is how it's done, do it. That doesn't work for me. Never worked for me, ever in my life. Why? I mean, I think that was probably the second word I said. Why? And then continually pressed until I was satisfied. Why? Because the art of it requires that you know why. Just as Satyavati said, some people say you should do this. Well, that's scientifically valid. But the art of it is to know whether it goes in your painting or not. Because purple could be a beautiful color, but if you put purple in the middle of your picture, it may make a mess of your picture.
Isn't that the flow?
The flow is another way of saying that. Is that what you meant?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just the feeling of it. Okay, now we have to get to that word, don't we? Feeling. Because it feels right. Because, let me think about that. What happens next? That's where we are. There's a lot of things. Intuition isn't just the first thing that comes to you. Intuition is more than receiving the guidance. Intuition is what you do with the guidance. Because the mere fact that God told you to do it is no guarantee that it will work and no guarantee that it will help you. It all depends on how you handle it. I had a very early experience on this. It had to do with the pilgrimages we were doing to India. That was really the point. Circumstances were such, I had this very strong intuition, which I know was a divine intuition because I could tell about what we ought to do. I became egoic, dogmatic, insensitive, and just make a long list of all the things that I used to be capable of doing before breakfast. Which I've had a lot of that beaten out of me over the years, so I'm not so inclined. So I took what I knew was a true intuition, and I used it like a hammer on a lot of other people. And as you might anticipate, they didn't appreciate it at all. And it just became an incredible mess, an absolute mess. Nobody wanted to believe me. It just got awful. So I suddenly realized, because if you're very strong-minded like I am, you also learn to backtrack and apologize. Everything has two sides. So if you're a bully and overbearing, you get really good at apologizing. So I realized that I was wrong, and I wrote a note to everyone involved. And I said, whether or not my intuitive idea was valid or not doesn't matter. Because at this point, I have carried it out in such a way that whatever truth there was in it has become completely confused. I totally withdraw. And I did. I dropped out. Everybody else went around for a long time and came right back to what I suggested. Because I really was, it was true. I knew it was true. But I spoiled it. And it ceased to be intuitive, because intuition does not justify ego. And intuition can be, you know, mother's milk to the wrong kind of ego. because now not only do I have an opinion, but my opinion is God's opinion. So a friend of mine made a very unpopular decision, and he made it on the basis of it was what God told him to do. I said to him, just as a friend, I said, you know, a lot of people don't agree with you. And why don't you let us just disagree with you? Why don't you not make us disagree with God? Wouldn't that be just nicer? Unfortunately, in the circumstance, he was too persuaded. But also, again, I'll quote Swami Kriyananda. He could have justified everything he did on the basis of divine intuition. He never did. He never said, I feel this is what God wants, in the sense of trying to use that to get you to be quiet. So part of control and trust is to realize that if it is true, the way Swamiji said it to me, truth will stand on its own. It does not need you to defend it. And this is where you start with intuition and you end up in emotion. Because you get afraid that people are not listening to you, that you're not going to get to do what you want. Now, that doesn't mean that you should give up. Swami alternatively said to me, if you think you are right, do not ever give up. I said, sir, but I'm completely off the wall. Said, no problem. I mean, he said, it doesn't matter. That's what he said. If you think you really think that you're right, don't give up. But you have to do it artfully. Because if you take the intuition to your ego, then it will corrupt, it will become corrupted, and your next decision will be a terrible one. So do you see how delicate that balance is? So sometimes everybody opposes you, and that just means you're right. Sometimes everybody opposes you, and that means you're wrong. And you just have to, that's the art of it. I proposed something once. It was actually when we were in the middle of the SRF litigation, and the idea came that we would go down to the SRF convocation and we would conduct an educational campaign, which translated into standing outside of the convocation holding signs telling the members about the lawsuit. It was a big thing, and that's a whole big story which I won't go into now. But it was intensely controversial, to put it mildly, as you can well imagine. But the idea had come to me in this certain way. That's the only way I can describe it, which does not happen to me that often, but when it happens, I recognize it. That does not mean it's going to come to fruition. That just means that it was true. And I'd learned something by this point, so I worked with it more artfully. But much later, when it was intensely controversial, and we're talking to Swami Kriyananda about it, and he was concerned that it wouldn't work out or this would happen, I said, sir, it came to me in that way, and he knew what I meant. Oh, he said, then of course you have to do it. Just like that. Meaning, you have to follow that kind of feeling. Just because people are opposing you, you can't back off. Now, in the other case, back with the pilgrimages, backing off was a strategy for sticking to the intuition, if you might know what I mean. I didn't repudiate the intuition. I repudiated the mistakes I'd made with the intuition. But I just allowed it to stand on its own. Now I'm much more skillful. And I realize that not every intuition gets fulfilled. But I'm certainly going to use as much will and magnetism as artfully as I can. And some intuitions are entirely up to you. Now I'm writing, which is wonderful for me, because I just get to do it my way. You know, it's just my intuition. And it's very relaxing for me after 30 years of leading a community where I still get my way a lot. But I also have to win a lot of people to my ideas. It's very relaxing just to do it exactly what I want. Swamiji always wanted me to write because he knew it would be very relaxing for me. And now, after all these years, I finally understand, because I do have a lot of intuition, and it's tiresome for me to have to get other people on my side. Now, some people's intuition is about getting everybody on their side. You know what I mean? It's like their intuition is how to work with groups. Like their art form is everybody's energy. And their intuition is how to work with everybody's energy. You know, it's just everybody's different. The medium of their art is everybody's energy and the joy of watching everybody work together, which I also enjoy. But not as profoundly as I do being a creative artist, where it's only my intuition. This is all part of your... Swamiji said to me once about a certain quality of mine, he said, in and of itself, it's not a fault. But in the position you are in, it is a serious fault. Mm. So all of that has to do with your squiggle. You know, as a writer, it's a virtue. As a leader of a community, it's not a very helpful quality to be so intent on my own ideas. That wasn't what he was talking about, but it's the same thing. You see? And we get intuition according to our own flow. And mathematicians do not usually get poetry. Poets usually do not get physics. Spiritual people do not usually get, you know, popular music. It's just like you get what you are. A friend of mine was a physicist. He was a PhD candidate at Stanford. He was a serious devotee. He said, I sit down with my physics problems in the morning, and I look up, and it's night. And he was concerned that this wasn't pleasing to God. I said, my friend, every day, bow down to your physics books. Put your forehead on your physics book and thank God that you can be so, that you love something so much that you can completely forget yourself. Self-forgetfulness. You see, that's what we're working with. And so that's where creative art and so on come through. I would like to take a short break, and then we'll come back for just half an hour, okay? So just refresh yourself in whatever way you need, and then return. Do not linger anywhere. Great souls, we have 30 minutes more, so whatever is left needs to be asked and answered at this point. I was asked a very important question during the break, so I want to start with that. How can I love? How can I serve? What if sometimes I resent the fact that people expect me to love and serve them? The question was actually put me, do you ever feel resentful? I have, a lot of times, we all do. Resentment is the battle between contractive and expansive energy. Now, to be serviceful, to put your own needs secondary to other people's needs is not always the most expansive choice. It depends entirely on the consciousness you're putting out and why you're doing it. Now, in principle, the more you can completely forget yourself and just think about taking care of others, that principle is valid. But there's a huge difference between suppression and transcendence. And that's really the important key here. If you push yourself farther than you have the capability to go, even if you can do it, you're often having to do it at the expense of your own self. You're just suppressing aspects of yourself that it is not healthy for you to suppress. Even in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says to Arjuna, the phrase is, of what avail is suppression? Of what purpose does it serve? Swami's answer was, if you suppress something that is a valid and genuine feeling inside of you, valid merely because it's very strong in your subconscious and it is part of you, not necessarily laudable, but nonetheless real, and you merely suppress it, his words were, it will simply come out in some weird way later. And then when it does come out, it will be totally unconnected to the cause. And you will not only have the original problem, whatever it might be, but now you will have a complex about that problem. And the complex is much harder to resolve than the issue itself. Thus, of what avail is it to suppress? To transcend is actually to face that I really do not, my child is crying and I do not want to get up. Why did I ever get pregnant in the first place? Having children was a terrible idea. And then you turn to your spouse and say, no, why did you ever make me do this? All these different things. This is not transcending. And my friend who was on her, it was her third or fourth child. And the child woke up in the night and she went downstairs and got a bottle of orange juice, as it was, to give to him in the night for whatever reason. She handed him the bottle of orange juice. The child was a toddler. He took it in his hands, but when she handed it to him, instead of being satisfied, he began to wail all the louder. And she just didn't have the wherewithal to sort it out, so she staggered back to bed and said, "There is something wrong with your son, you need to go see." So what had happened was, rather than screwing on the top of the bottle, she had set it on the lawn. So what happened from her son's point of view is, mommy comes in, pours orange juice over his head, drops the bottle on him, and walks away. Which is really not the system he was looking for. Unfortunately, the husband and wife were very much in harmony with each other, and it just became funny because he goes in there and finds that the poor child soaked in orange juice, and just dad soaked in orange juice, and just sort of works the whole thing out. Having children especially just eats you. It gives you no self. My friend who said to me, "I thought I was a very selfless guy," he said, "until my two sons were born. And then I found out that being selfless means that you don't exist. It's not a question of your being nice. It's that you simply cease to exist. Because your children believe that you were born to take care of them. And in fact, you are." So part of it is a lot of things. Family, you marry, you have careers, all these different things. You've just gotten yourself boxed into something. And this is where it becomes a question of control and trust, of intuition versus emotion. We start down a certain path, and certain things come with it. And we may resent it, but nobody did it to us. We did it to ourselves. So once you have resentment, you can't just pretend, "Oh, I love taking care of my family. Look at these darling children. I'm just so happy that I have six of them. I just so happy I have six of them. My husband doesn't earn any money, and I also have to have a full-time job." You know? It's just wonderful. That is not transcendence. But to say, "What could I have been thinking?" Quietly to yourself, not in front of your children. You know, this was just nuts. I really don't think I can handle this. I really don't think I can go on. One of my friends who, she eventually had five children. At the time, she only had four. And she told me she was just lying on the couch while four of them were running around screaming. And she thought to herself, "One of them just has to go. They're just too many." And it was a perfectly honest response. Of course, she wasn't going to eliminate one of them. But she wasn't going to suppress the thought either, because there was no point in suppressing it. She was up against it. And I mean, one of my friends said, two was okay because, you know, it was one-on-one combat. He said, when there were three of them, the odds changed and it became very different, because then they could gang up on us and we couldn't keep them in line. So you can't suppress those thoughts. They're a fact. And you can't suppress the thought seriously that I really never wanted this. It just came on me for who knows what reason. I'm talking about families and children because I'm talking about inescapable responsibilities. Because if you resent something and it's in your power to shift it, even if it takes a great deal of will and magnetism, it's quite different than when you are trapped. But don't suppress it. But then the art comes. I can't really get rid of one of them, you know, or I don't want to divorce my husband, or he's become sick and I'm the only breadwinner, or at this point this is the only profession I have and I need to do it, we have a mortgage and all these kids to raise. You just have to really face into it, and then you have to go, where is it, subconscious, superconscious, I'm not sure, none of this really works for you. You just have to go to God and you have to say, "Here it is, the glorious trust. If you've given it to me, that must mean you're going to give me the power to deal with it." And you just lie on the floor and weep until you're tired of doing that. And then you say, "You know, I'm so resentful. I can hardly stand it. What are we going to do about it?" And you might think you can't be a drug addict and a disciple of a great master at the same time. You can have an absolutely stinky attitude, and if you're going to have a really stinky attitude, just put God next to you. "We hate this, Lord. We can't stand doing this." So you're just going to have to stand with you, because this is just driving me crazy. Do not suppress it. the first step to transcendence is to accept that it exists. Swami uses the phrase, you've got to accept reality. And that doesn't mean that you are content with reality. But the beginning of transcendence is you have to know that it needs to be transcended. If you won't even admit that much as these children are wonderful, or this husband is wonderful, or this job is wonderful, or my aging parents are wonderful, I really resent having to deal with this. I remember different times I say, I just whisper to myself, or I whisper in front of the altar, I have a really stinky attitude. You know, I know that my life is full of blessings, but you know this particular thing? I think it's awful. And Jesus said, let this cup pass from me. Meaning, he had an opinion. I love that. He had an opinion. It wasn't that he didn't want to be crucified. What he wanted was for those he came to serve to accept the message that he was bringing. It wasn't the crucifixion. It was their rejection of his divine message. Please, Lord, I came to help them. Can't you open their hearts? Let this cup pass from me, he said. Then he said, let thy will, not mine, be done. But the first thing he did was express an opinion, which gives us all permission. And you see, then you're there you are. That's the art of it. You know, I remember I was in such a tough period. It was when we were in the litigation for 12 years. Ananda was sued twice. It was a big deal. It was awful. We had some awful experiences. And I remember saying to someone, it's a good thing I've had other experiences on the path besides this one. Mm-hmm. Because this is a terrible experience. And if this was all there was to the spiritual path, I would not still be on it. Just say it out loud. You know, Master says, let's see. I'll tell you one more on this and then I'll take another question. At Ananda Village in the early years, the community was so small. We were so poor. We had very few cars. We had no money. And we always knew where everybody was because nobody could really go anywhere. Not that we minded, but, you know, nobody could go anywhere. It's not like here where people get in their cars and who knows where they are. We always knew. And, of course, whenever Swami did anything, we were all there. And Swami gave a Kriya initiation, and this one man didn't show up. Swami said to me the next day, why don't you find out how he is? He was a little concerned. Maybe he's sick because we were isolated. He could have been. Maybe he's sick, something wrong. So I said, you know, Swami, you noticed your absence and wanted to know why you didn't come. He said, I didn't feel like bowing down to the gurus last night. That's what he said like that. But he was a very honest man. I went and I said, Swami, this is what he said. Swami said, I understand. I feel that way sometimes too. I was just like, so what? Do you think everybody else hasn't been there too? You have to accept what's real. If you're an apple seed, you just have to go through every stage. And we are fair enough. Okay, any other questions, comments, or thoughts? Anything left uncovered that you wanted to know? Yes.
I just have a comment that based on what you said, it just feels like it's okay to take the burden off yourself to just be good and to look good all the time. Just accept what you really are, and it's fine.
It's more than fine. It's much more than fine. Yeah. It's absolutely essential. And on the subject of intuition, it's absolutely essential. Because if you are bringing to God a pretense, there is no way he can give you truth. And he can't guide you to do something if you're asking him to guide you in something that has no relationship to you because you're afraid to ask what the real question is. And the real question might be, I hate being on the spiritual path. I hate the pressure of this. I really don't want to do any of this. I'm so sick of being good. What are we going to do? That's a real question. And there's a real answer to that. Instead of shining on as if you could actually fool him. And then you can't get any answers because there's nobody home. You're asking about somebody else's karma, so there's no intuition for that, which is another way of saying, you know, you have to ask the right question to get the right answer. And if the right question is, I am such a stinker and I really don't want to be different, what are we going to do about that? And then you find that Divine Mother has a great sense of humor. She's used to her naughty babies. She really is. She really doesn't care. In fact, sometimes I've seen Swami push people really hard. Often, and I just wrote about this recently, often he would say something that seemed very straightforward, was actually not at all what he meant in the meaning of the words, but he needed to push a person. For example, this one man was in love with a woman whom he eventually married, but his concept of himself was that he would have no attachments, that he wouldn't, you know, do anything like this. So the question he brought to Swami was not, what do I do about being in love with this woman, but how can I advance on the spiritual path? Swami said, join the monastery, you should join the monastery, which caused him to say, no, like that, because really, he was really in love with this woman, but he couldn't admit it. So Swami pushed him in the false direction, which caused him to react. Oh, okay. And then when he was honest, Swami would say, it doesn't matter. Marry, be a monk, doesn't make any difference for you. But honesty was where we had to get before there was any answer to the question. So another reason why sometimes why answers don't come is because you're not asking the right question. For example, you might be, well, sometimes we have past life relationships with people that never resolved in that life, which make us very upset in this life. And we can't tell the difference. So we have resentments, we have angers, we have jealousies, we have distrusts that are very real. They're just not in the present, but they're very real. So we're always asking God, you know, help me to forgive, help me to forgive, help me to forgive. But I don't really want to forgive. I want them to apologize. That's what I want. I want retribution. Mm-hmm. I want to be acknowledged for being right. This is something I've had to work through a lot. And all you're asking is, help me to forgive, help me to forgive. No, you have to say, you know, what am I so upset about? You know, how do I calm this? You know, he says, forgiveness is not the question. The question is, you know, help me to calm the seething cauldron. At least, you know, I need to get neutral before I can get positive. Just when you can't get an answer and you keep trying, consider asking a different question. Mm-hmm. Because, to quote Swami Priyananda, it's not hard to know what God wants. So usually we're asking the wrong question when we don't know. And sometimes it's quite humiliating to realize what the actual question is. You know, sometimes the actual question is so little. Like, how can I, you know, how can I just not be curious? Forgiveness is way off the picture. How can I stop being obsessive? Fair enough? Any other questions or thoughts? I'm going to be like the auctioneer and give you the last. If not, that's it then. Okay. This was recorded but not videoed, so therefore it will appear on the Ananda Palo Alto website, because it can't go on YouTube because there is no tube.